And I don't even have to wear headphones for this one. This is great.
Yeah, that's another plus of being in studio. You don't have sweaty ears when you're done.
Yeah, hate sweaty ears.
Sweaty ears for life. Just happens. Don't shave.
Just to be clear, he's recording all of this.
Good.
Thanks, Tom.
I leave now, confidently knowing I have pre-roll.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Bike Shed. I'm your host, Chris Toomey, and I'm joined today by Alex Sullivan, mobile developer here in our Boston office. Alex, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris.
I introduced you as a mobile developer, which is decidedly true. Often folks on our team will have a bit of a specialization, so Android being one of those, iOS, React Native. You have sort of branched out into all of the different worlds, and even some of the lesser known ones that we'll dig into.
The sub-worlds.
Yes. But yeah, can you talk a little bit about your experience and your background and where you're coming from on the mobile world? And then I think we'll dig into some of those platforms in a little more specific.
Yeah, sure. So I've been doing mobile development for maybe the past 5 years or so. Honestly, every time I say the amount I've been doing it, it varies between like, it's been 3 years and it's been 15 years. The latter is definitely a lie.
Well, there's also that complexity where the arrow of time keeps moving forward.
Oh,
so
yeah,
you have
yeah.
to keep updating the
yeah,
map.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate. Yeah, exactly. So I think maybe I've been saying 5 years for
number of years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I've been a mobile developer for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I started off working on a voice over IP app for a English networking company based out of San Francisco, which
that
is an interesting combination
yeah.
of locations. And that was just general debugging. I moved from there to a company called Runkeeper, where I worked on an app called Runkeeper, doing kind of both the Android stuff and the iOS stuff. Got more focused and specialized towards the Android end of things, then did some freelancing, also mostly focused on the Android side of things, but with the occasional iOS work thrown in there. And then I've been kind of a little bit all over the place here at Thoughtbot, so it's been a ride.
So the all over the place is you're currently on an iOS project. You have done a good amount of Android. And have you done any actual React Native client projects?
Yeah, so I was on a React Native project for 2 weeks,
okay.
I believe. So really flexing my muscles there.
Mm-hmm. So which is your favorite?
Yeah, good question.
to dig right into the heart of the thing.
Yeah, yeah. So my heart lies with Android. Mm-hmm. My soul is with the little green Android. That's definitely where I'm at home. That's my comfort zone. That's the place where I'm most confident. That's the place where I feel super confident in criticizing and being mean about the platform. You know, when you just fully know a platform, so
right.
you're like, these are all the terrible things about it.
Yeah.
But I can say that because it's kind of my baby.
Right,
even
right.
though it's not mine at all.
But you feel like you've gotten there. You've
yeah,
understood enough
exactly.
that you're not mischaracterizing
yes,
when you
yes,
make... Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So definitely at home at Android, but I've been doing iOS development also for, again, like the same amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
It's been... Most of my personal projects have been in Android, and that's where I've, you know, that's where I post on subreddits and stuff like that. Let me put it that way.
Right. that's a good way to describe going steady with the platform.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's nice 1950s lingo. I like
Thank
it.
Thank you.
But I've been doing iOS development kind of for the whole time I've been doing Android mm-hmm. development. So
this is probably a hard thing for you to do, but I'd love to start with the two core platforms mm-hmm. of Android and iOS. And can you give like a brief characterization for someone who's a little bit outside of those worlds?
Yeah.
What would you describe as like the strengths and mm-hmm. the relative weaknesses of the two of them?
Yeah, definitely. So this probably won't surprise anybody. Android's very open. It's less open than it was in previous years, but you can do lots of different stuff. You can root your Android phone, and as an app developer, you can interact with rooted Android phones. That whole realm is open to you.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to pay $100 a year to develop apps for it. You can just...
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
So it's the Apple Developer Program?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's a little more egalitarian, let's say.
That feels like such a weird tax for them to impose.
Yeah.
And so also, like, any limitation, I wonder if it's a quality filter in their
minds. I think it is. And I think, I think it actually ends up being a good idea. And nowadays, if you want to put up an app on the Play Store, I think you need to pay a one-time fee of $25. So I think Google has also said, all right, well, let's try to find some way to limit the hordes and hordes of nonsensical, ridiculous apps that have come out. So Android kind of has the anything goes, it's the Wild West thing going for it, which has its attraction. I'm sure someone who's intimately familiar in like the JavaScript world kind of understands the attraction.
I was going to say, have you heard about the web?
Yes, exactly.
Nobody
yeah.
tells us what to do on the web.
Yeah. Slightly similar situation on Android. On the iOS side of things, I would describe it as a fair bit more clamped down. Mm-hmm. However, I will say this. Apple provides, in my opinion, a much better, or at least a much more cohesive SDK. Everything in the Apple world fits together. You get the sense that you're using Legos to put things together, mm-hmm. and blocks are meant to go together. Whereas on the Android side of things, you do not get that sense. I actually heard somebody give a very interesting characterization of PHP that I think applies to Android development too, which is you want to go build something and you're given a toolbox. And you open up the toolbox and you want a hammer. But you can't find a hammer. All you can find is that hammer with the weird spiky bits at the end. Then you say, like, okay, well, yeah, I mean, I can use this. Like, I can bash a nail in with this. All right, so that works fine. And then you need Phillips head screwdriver, but you only have the flathead one. Mm-hmm. But you can still do it, right? You know, you can kind of force it in there and then get in the nooks and, and you can make it go. And that is just, it's that all the way down. That's starting to change a little bit. So recently, meaning within the past year or two, the Android team has taken a more proactive approach to helping app developers with cohesive architectures. Mm-hmm. So they've started releasing new components. There's View Model, which is a UI architecture component, and Room, which is a database solution, to try and say, okay, here's actually a philosophy for building an Android app. Hmm. And that's stuff that the iOS world has kind of had from the beginning. So,
yeah, the idea that you're so... Like, even in the better case that you're describing of iOS, that you're still so limited and you have to work from those pieces is just so antithetical to me of the essential wild, wild west of the web. But it is interesting, and there are the trade-offs that you have the ability to get on devices and to access functionality that you don't have access to. Although the web is catching up. Yeah. There's weird things where, like, the accelerometer somehow is now accessible on the web.
It's really astounding, some of the stuff. And I'm now being asked for my location permission for every website I go to. So.
You're just a local news site. Please stop asking me for my location. It's weird. Yeah. No.
You're local. I live here.
Well, I think a similar characterization then... There are languages that are fundamental to the two platforms. Mm-hmm. And I think in both cases, they've sort of changed over the years. So historically, Android had Java.
Yep.
And then more recently, Kotlin has gained a lot of favor there. And then on the iOS side, there was Objective-C. Mm-hmm. And then that has been supplanted by the actual official Swift. Mm-hmm. Whereas Kotlin is an unofficial community. Actually, I've probably reached the end of what I know. So can you correct anything I said that was wrong there?
I can pick it up from there. So the Android team did officially adopt Kotlin.
Okay.
They didn't create Kotlin.
Right.
It's an interesting evolution where Apple was working on Swift for a long time and then kind of released it and to a lot of fanfare and a lot of joy, rightfully so. And it kind of feels sometimes like Google looked around really quickly and was like, oh, hey, look at that. Look at Kotlin. Mm-hmm. Everyone's using that already. All right, we'll say this is our answer to Swift.
Right.
Sort like of bless a very it for the platform. Conveniently placed language. But yeah, so everything has moved off from, in the Android world, from Java to Kotlin. There's really, at this point, no reason to start. Like, creating a new file in Java is a very questionable thing to do nowadays.
You would look at a PR that's introducing a new Java file and be like,
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's not rare at all to have side-by-side like code bases that contain both, of course. And the interop between Kotlin and Java is quite excellent, really fantastic. Mm-hmm. I think that they kind of hit it out of the park there. Apple hit it out of the park with Swift and did not hit it out of the park with the interop.
The interop back down to Objective-C.
To Objective-C, yeah. Gotcha. You go through all these bridging files, and I have found it to be a very painful experience to interop between Objective-C and Swift.
Interesting.
But yeah, the languages have also, I think, started to go in different directions. So when Kotlin came out, there was a big question of why does this language exist? Mm-hmm. So the JVM world has a host of languages already. Obviously, Java's a giant one within there. But there's also Scala. And there were people who used Scala to write Android apps. There were people at Thoughtbot who used Scala to write
Android
apps.
There were people who hosted this podcast at Thoughtbot who used Scala to write Android apps.
Fantastic. So there was, a bit of a question of why Kotlin needs to exist when Scala exists. And I think the answer that they went with that makes a lot of sense is Scala is fantastic. I mean, we use it a lot at Thoughtbot, and it's a beautiful language. It's a lot. Right? Hmm. There's a lot going on in Scala. There's a lot of ways to shoot yourself in the foot, and it's intimidating. So Kotlin kind of moved forward as everyone knows that there's a lot of cruft in Java. Everyone knows that there's a lot of stuff that's tedious. There's a lot of boilerplate and a lot of stuff that Scala has that we wish we could use. Mm-hmm. But we want to do that without implicits and without the bonkers inline method style that Scala lets you do.
Underscores sort of everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Those underscores are interesting.
They
in Scala,
are interesting.
I will say
they
that.
Mean
yeah.
so many things.
They mean all the things. And yeah. implicits, just to loop back to that, is a language feature for dependency injection and yeah. type classes and a whole host of features, but it's sort of the best and worst feature yeah. of Scala
exactly.
is mostly what I hear about it.
Yeah.
But incredibly powerful.
Yep.
And very intimidating.
Yeah, very magical too.
Yeah.
And so Kotlin kind of stepped in there as, let's be a better Java. Let's be Java 2.0, but let's not get carried away the way we feel like Scala may have. And I think Swift was positioned slightly different in that Objective-C, I think actually is a pretty great language. I enjoyed it.
I have not heard that take before.
Yeah, yeah. People really dislike Objective-C. I think it's something about the way the brackets work out. They always line up perfectly. It's beautiful.
So aesthetically, you enjoy
aesthetically,
the language Objective-C.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
I mean, that's a reason.
Yeah. Definitely wasn't as strongly typed as one would hope.
Mm.
But I think there was an obvious need for a modern language there. Mm-hmm. Objective-C had some nice tidbits in there, but it was clear that this was like a competitor to... Was it a competitor to C++ when it came out?
I think that's true.
Yeah. So really a need for modernization kind of created Swift. And Apple has been going farther with Swift than I think JetBrains, who are the maintainers of Kotlin, have been going with Kotlin. So I think Kotlin really has that goal of not getting carried away. And I think that that's kind of reining them back a bit. So you're not getting type classes. You're definitely not getting implicits or any mm-hmm. of the sort of the meaty stuff in the functional Scala world. And Swift has been opening it up a bit more. So you have more complex pattern matching in Swift. The enums are a bit more powerful than sealed classes in Kotlin. The type system has some interesting differences mm-hmm. that I would argue make Swift's type system a bit more powerful than Kotlin's. There's built-in support for tuples and all that sort of stuff. So
are there not support for tuples in Kotlin?
There's support for pairs. There is a pair object, but there is no support for arbitrary tuples.
Ah, yeah. Gotcha.
So I think that they're starting to go in different directions, and Swift is starting to kind of flex its muscles a bit.
I'm not surprised by that because Apple obviously has some power there, some ability yeah. to both in terms of just sheer headcount that they mm-hmm. can dedicate to it mm-hmm. as a project, but also it fits more with their core business model as far as I see it. Mm. Like if they can build a better language that attracts more people to work on their platform, that gets more apps, et cetera, that's pretty clear. JetBrains, they make IntelliJ and other IDEs, and it is a little less clear how investing more in Kotlin mm-hmm. leads back. Like the idea that they are the people behind Kotlin, and Kotlin has seemingly been very well received by the world, but it's got to be hard for them to put anywhere near the resources that Apple can into Swift. So I'm not surprised to hear that there's that sort of thing going on. But I also wonder how much like the community involvement differs. As far as I can tell, Swift is largely developed internally at Apple. And then open source, is it open source at this point?
Yeah, Swift is open source at this point.
But it's more of a like deliver decided things to open source and let people see the code rather than developed in the open.
Yeah. That's my understanding, yeah.
Yeah. Is Kotlin developed in the open?
Yeah, Kotlin is as open source as you can get. And another thing that's worth noting is I'm pretty sure at this point that Google is stepping in a bit more with Kotlin and helping contribute some of their push for it.
Gotcha.
Another thing that I think Apple is willing to do is to make constant breaking changes to the language. So it's astounding. Whenever you look up an answer on Stack Overflow or something like that, you'll have four answers.
Oh.
This is the Objective-C answer, this is the Swift 2 answer, this is the Swift 3 answer, and this is the Swift 4 answer.
So within one Stack Overflow answer, they'll have like the bolded head.
Yes.
Oh, God.
Yeah. It's interesting because in the Java world, there's such an emphasis on backwards compatibility and making sure we don't break things. And they just threw that away. And that comes with a lot of niceties, right? So the language is always the best they can imagine it, theoretically. But it also comes with all the information being outdated everywhere. So
trade-offs.
It's definitely a frustrating scenario to be like, I have this perfectly working answer. Ooh, Swift 3 answer, not Swift 4. Don't have that problem.
So close. It is interesting, though, the parallels between the two languages because they share, I would say, a common foundation. Oh, I'm saying this like I know anything. I have heard that they share a common foundation in strongly typed functional, leaning into that, moving away from object-oriented in either case. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think I would push back on that a little bit, at least from the Kotlin side, in that Kotlin is still built to be an object-oriented language, right? It really is Java's successor. It just also includes, like its standard library includes map and filter and flat map and stuff that we've come to associate with functional paradigms. I also have to admit that functional comes with so much baggage in my head now that it's like, is this Haskell? Is this, you know, crazy
when you say
Scala?
Functional, what do you mean?
Yeah. So I don't have a great answer for that. But I would say that Colin especially is still very much an object-oriented mm-hmm. language.
Which I don't, like, I think I framed the question mm-hmm. in a way that I was trying to treat those as distinct things, mm-hmm. but I don't think that they are. Like, Scala is somewhat famously both an object-oriented and a strongly functional language. Mm-hmm. And even Ruby, to a certain extent, like, definitely got the object-oriented going mm-hmm. on, but it has Enumerable, which is a library or a module within it that allows for map and filter and select mm-hmm. and all of those. And not quite the same support for first-class functions, which mm-hmm. I think is a differentiator for Ruby and makes it a little harder to work in that modality or a little harder to work in that paradigm. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting seeing the strong type system. Being, I'm trying to think of a language right now that's in the forefront that doesn't have that going on.
Yeah,
Ruby, obviously, but that's, you know, historically. But new languages, mm-hmm. like thinking of Kotlin, Swift, TypeScript, Elm. Mm-hmm. Closure is the one that comes to mind, but I think Closure also has a long history.
Yeah, I know nothing about Closure.
There's a lot of parentheses.
Yeah, that's the sense I've gotten.
As far as I know, it's a Lisp that targets the JVM, and then it has a Closure script, which has same sort of idea of compiled to JavaScript going on. You can probably write Closure to target Android, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah.
Based
probably.
On, like, it's JVM, so
people
at the end
write
of the day,
Python to target Android.
Oh, we do a lot of things as programmers.
Yeah.
We were so caught up in whether or not we should. We didn't stop. No, wait, I got that backwards. We were so caught up in whether or not we could. We didn't stop to think if we should. Classic examples.
Oh, yeah.
How do you like the languages? Like, if you had to, if you were picking on a day to day basis, disregarding the platform constraints, what do you think of the two languages?
Yeah. So they're both fantastic languages. My heart really rests with Kotlin, but that also may be because I'm intimately familiar with it. Mm-hmm. I use Swift every day now, but I am firmly aware of Kotlin's abilities. So I've found, and again, this comes from the perspective of somebody who's been doing a lot of Java development, I have found Kotlin to be a very intuitive language, extremely easy to pick up. So I would say any Java developer or anyone familiar with JavaScript, anything along those lines, like within that realm of C, you know, syntax, can pick up Kotlin very quickly. It just feels well-designed. It feels familiar. It feels clear what it can and can't do. As soon as you get over, like, type erasure in the JVM world, then everything just fits.
Can you describe what that is?
Yeah, it just means that if you have generic types, those generic types disappear at runtime. So if I have some function that takes in an object of type T, I can't query the type of T in the function because that T is gone. Mm-hmm. You just get a real object in instead. There are very specific cases where generic types become slightly more difficult to deal with because you can't do that runtime checking on the generic type itself. Mm-hmm. Swift has reified types, which gets around that, which is very nice. But I feel like Kotlin makes a lot of sense and makes a lot of pragmatic decisions. I would characterize Swift as being more powerful. Like I mentioned before, its enums and switch statements are closer to Scala's in that they're kind of just more powerful. You can match off the shape of objects and you can kind of
destructure. And the switch that you're talking about there, I'm guessing that's more of a pattern matching level than like JavaScript switch statement, which has its stuff going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So it's a much more powerful construct that you're describing.
Yeah. And that's fantastic. It really lets you pull apart your structs and all that sort of stuff very nicely. There's little things that keep coming up to bite me in Swift that I would not expect. You don't have interfaces in Swift. You have things called protocols, which you can, I'm sure somebody will be upset about this, but you can describe as an interface. And in Java or most other typed languages, you can provide a generic type for that interface. Mm-hmm. So I could have interface list with generic type T, which just means anything can go into a list. In Swift, you don't have a type T on your protocol. You have an associated type with it, which roughly maps out to the way you do generics in Swift protocols. But one side effect of that approach is that if I have some class, I can't just declare a variable that is of type my protocol T. Or whatever. It can only be used as a constraint later on when you're declaring functions or classes, which is something that really hit me in the face right out of right field. Just did not expect that. And there have been a lot of little things like that that I've found coming up with Swift, where I go through some mechanism that feels wonderful. The optional chaining Swift has is very nice. And then I'll get hit by some other edge like that that makes me think, oh, man, that's not friendly. That's not the way I'd imagine this to work. And usually I like it when things work the way I imagine that they would work.
That's weird.
Yeah, right?
No, strange. That's super normal. That's a very normal thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that all makes sense, and I followed almost all of it. It's type systems become one of those things where it's very easy to get lost in like Scala particularly. Yeah. I occasionally will look at Scala code with generics and covariants and contravariants, and I'm just like, no, I'm going to go back over here for a little while. But I love the power of strongly typed languages and having a compiler and getting that feedback. Yes. And I'm actually interested in what the development workflow feels like, because I'm working on a TypeScript app right now. And having the TypeScript compiler running in a side window and giving me that feedback and working against that and only checking in the browser after multiple minutes of iteration with the compiler as my only feedback is so much better of an experience. Because that loop to go all the way out to the browser to render the full JavaScript file, get into the browser, parse it, compile it, click around as necessary to get to the point of execution, it's just a lot longer and more indirect. So I wonder, how would you characterize the development experience across the two platforms, and how well do they take advantage of the functional type system stuff going on?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think to get into that question, you need to also take a look at what environment you use for both of them.
You mean you're not just writing in Vim?
Nope, not just writing in Vim. Huh. Though sometimes. Sometimes I wish.
One time I made you one afternoon, but otherwise.
Yes.
Yeah.
So on the Android side, you use Android Studio, which is an offshoot of IntelliJ. Basically, it just comes with a few extra bells and whistles, but it's the same core experience. And on the iOS side, obviously, you use Xcode. Mm-hmm. So my experience with developing Android apps and Java apps and Java programs in general is that I don't go through the compile step. There's one step earlier, right, which is my IDE gives me a big old red underline, and that's my feedback if something will run or not.
And so that feedback, that red underline, is coming from the editor, the IDE, running a compiler in the background for you,
exactly.
And then providing that feedback.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
That's the dream.
Yeah, yeah. It's wonderful. And in Android Studio, that's my flow. So if something fails to build, that's very surprising. That is not a flow that I expect to be in when I'm developing Android apps. In iOS land, the situation is a bit different. Mm. I will come out and say it. I have no love for Xcode. I find it to be a frustrating experience to write Swift in Xcode. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons being I depend on that feedback so deeply from the IDE. And anyone who uses IntelliJ a lot can also attest to how great the look-ahead completion is and all that sort of jazz. And I didn't realize it before I moved off of it, but I have really come to depend on that.
I don't actually know how to do this thing.
I don't know what any method name is anymore. Mm-hmm. All I know is the first three letters and then a tab. So on the Xcode side of things, I'd say it takes 2 to 5 seconds for the IDE to tell you, hey, this doesn't match. So in the Xcode world, I'm finding myself much more often building the app to see if it actually builds, which is frustrating because it's a much longer turnaround.
Yep.
And there's also a lot of times where there will be some mistake, or I'll be in the middle of typing something and I stop for long enough that the IDE picks it up and gives me some error and never gets rid of it. So I'll change the code and it'll just sit on that same error, and you need to run the app to clear that. Yeah. So the development experience on the Android side, at least in terms of writing the actual code, I find to be quite pleasant, and I find it to be fairly painful on the iOS side.
Hmm. That's unfortunate.
What's interesting is that JetBrains offers a competitor to Xcode called AppCode, which you can use, which I immediately downloaded after day two. And theirs is no quicker than Xcode. So it's the same amount of time to get feedback on your Swift code. So I'm wondering if it's just the Swift compiler. It's just slow.
My understanding of how most of these systems work these days is they're spinning up a compiler in the background and they're watching as files change, but they're maintaining a cached representation of the majority of files. When you when you write one file and say, this one has now changed, it only needs to recompile for that and can do, like, that should be a sub-second operation in almost all cases.
Yep.
And I'm surprised if Swift is not doing that, or if they've taken a different approach, or, like, I can't imagine that they're spinning up the compiler anew each time.
Yeah, that can't be.
But maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good question. I haven't done a lot of research into why is this so slow.
Yeah.
But that would be a good thing to dive into to try to figure out what is it that makes this take so long.
Yeah. As an aside, I'm so excited about the developments that are happening in that world of compilers and feedback and IDE-like behavior. So the whole language server protocol, which VS Code, coming from Microsoft, introduced. And then TypeScript was the first client or the first server, the language that implemented it. But that same idea of, I'll be honest, I don't love IDEs. I find them
totally
very heavyweight. Yep. And there's also just a lot of visual cruft. Someone said this, Gary Bernhardt said this on Twitter the other day, and it rang so true with me that I was surprised I haven't said it more aloud. But it's, there's so much stuff on the screen. How do you not get so distracted? That's one of the things I like about Vim is I'm just looking at the code.
Yeah.
And there's the little bit of extra information of squiggles or something pointing at the line or something like that. But it's only that information and everything else is hidden. And absolutely, the first time you open Vim, it's the worst and you don't know how to quit. Although I was working on a server for a client the other day and it's a remote environment that I don't own and someone had configured the shell to be Emacs. So I accidentally was trying to edit something or was doing like a git commit or something that spawned the dollar editor and it was Emacs and I was like, oh my God, I don't know how to quit. Now I get how everyone, when everyone says that about Vim, now I know.
Oh,
I eventually
learned
how to quit.
Congratulations.
Thank you. First step in mastering any command line based editor is learning how to quit it. But that whole idea of not needing a full IDE, but having naming the features that make like type ahead completion, auto formatting is one that I'm seeing introduced. And I'm like, I love that. Yeah, I definitely want that. And jump to definition, compiler errors, warnings, linting, all of that, and integrating that into a separated process.
Yeah.
That then, like, sure, Vim works or Emacs or IntelliJ or. I don't like if my editor knows too much about a language. A lot of IDEs have features around refactoring. It's like, I, as an editor, am very smart about Kotlin code, and I know how to perform this refactoring. It's like, that's not what my editor's job is. My editor's job is to interact with keystrokes that I send to it and update a text buffer, and then ideally externalize the more language-specific functionality.
I definitely agree. It'll be a beautiful day where I can fluently build Android apps or iOS apps just using Vim. That would be very cool.
That is the dream. But even TypeScript, which is the one that should be the furthest along in this, it is still a struggle. I've been trying to get Vim TypeScript with completion and jump to definition. And it seems like actually a pretty well-defined problem. And the server implementation exists because that's what VS Code uses. But the client side, the thing that is running in Vim to interact with that server, just nobody can get it right, or at least yet. I know that this is a solvable problem, and I expect that they will solve it. I just want that now.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth recognizing, too, that, I mean, the people behind IntelliJ have been building IntelliJ for, I don't know how long, 15 years or 10 years, however long it is. So it makes sense that it's going to take a hot minute for
It turns out it's one of
up.
Those really hard problems to do that performantly, to like do syntax highlighting on a file that may be 10,000 lines long.
Yeah.
How do you even... I actually don't know the algorithms and the data structures.
Yep.
And it's one of those things that I have on a list of like, man, if I had like a weird weekend where I was in a cabin in the woods but still had internet, maybe I'd build a text editor and learn about that. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, though. We're going to take a quick break to tell you about today's sponsor. This episode is brought to you by CircleCI, the continuous integration and delivery service used by companies like Twilio, Intuit, WeWork, and Tinder, as well as us here at ThoughtBot. CI and CD are so important for keeping teams building. It's all CircleCI does. They focus on creating powerful, flexible CI/CD pipelines so that you and your team can focus on doing what you do best. Whether you're a company of 5 or 500, CircleCI can build, test, and deploy your Linux and macOS projects from GitHub and Bitbucket in their cloud or installed on your servers. And anyone can sign up and start building for free, since CircleCI gives both private and public projects 1,000 free build minutes per month. Sign up and start building for free at CircleCI.com/BikeShed. Thank you to CircleCI for supporting this episode of The Bike Shed. But anyway, to come back to some more topical things, we talked a bunch about the languages, the platforms, the developer experience, but all of Android and iOS directly. But we hinted at a secret third option, which is React Native. So you have poked around a little bit with it. I'm intrigued by your thoughts, where you think it fits, where you think it doesn't fit, perhaps even more interestingly. How do you feel about React Native?
Yeah, so I'm still developing my thoughts on React Native. It's an area that I want to improve my expertise on. So I'm still to some degree in the stage where you're battling a new environment. And when you're you have that sense of like, oh, I could fly through this in a native Android app, but I, you know, I'm being forced to kind of work around my limited knowledge in the platform. So I'll put that out there as a disclaimer, just so I don't have to make strong statements.
No, make them. You're free to make them now.
Good.
And
yeah,
you've
exactly.
disclaimed them earlier. Yeah, exactly. So no, please continue.
Now I can just make forcefully false statements, and I've got that in front of them.
The thing about the internet is the best way to get the correct answer is to put the wrong one out there. So.
Exactly. That's a good point. It's a learning experience. Yeah, so my thoughts right now are there's a ton that's awesome about React Native, right? Cross-platform is good. React Native's not the first, and it won't be the last. Contentious statement. I think it's fantastic that it's opened up the world of mobile development to traditionally web developers. You know, they've been such different environments that have practically resulted in people being siloed off in one land or the other, that it's awesome seeing a thing bridge that gap. I really like React. I don't have any experience with Angular or any of the competitors in the web space, but my interactions with React are very positive. I love reactive development in general. I use it all the time in iOS and Android, so thumbs up on that.
I would be careful conflating those.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I know.
I think they chose the name a little questionably. And sure. So like when you say reactive there, I think you're talking about RxJS or RxJava, that type of reactivity.
Or just, I guess I interpret reactive programming as meaning stuff goes in circles, kind of, which could be an incorrect definition.
I don't know the actual like core definition. I think it is a term of art. I think it has some meaning, and I think it's not specifically the thing that React is. But as you say, well, I think of it as things going in circles, like inputs becoming the outputs of one thing, becoming the inputs to another, and then data flows and loops back up. And that's probably close to the right thing, but I know... Historically, when React came out, there was a bunch of like, oh, wait, we already used that word for a thing. That's not what this, like, reactive conf has nothing to do with React. But I think, actually, the way you just said it, that your mindset of what that means is in the right place. And React definitely does have that sort of data flow.
It utilizes that bit. Yeah. I mean, I guess I would call the whole set state re-render widget tree. Ooh, widget tree. I just showed my loyalties.
It's fine. You disclaimered. You're good.
I disclaimer. Re-render the stuff. I would consider that a reactive flow.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, so kind of getting more into the weeds a little bit, people praise React Native partially as a great cross-platform development tool. And I think it's worth recognizing that there were other ones in the past, and they weren't just web views, which I think a lot of people go to. They think of like PhoneGap or Ionic maybe, old Ionic maybe. And there were tools like Xamarin, which was kind of the de facto solution for a long time that I think has plummeted since React Native came out.
And what was Xamarin?
Xamarin was a cross-platform mobile environment written in C# to build mobile apps. And I think that my understanding, I haven't actually written any Xamarin code, was that you would write your UI for Android and you'd write your UI for iOS, and then you'd have a common backing model. So the logic would be the same, but you might still write two different UIs. I think there were, I think Xamarin Forms was a thing that allowed you to write a single UI for both of them, but it was considered kind of a hacky sort of thing that you might not want to use. So I think it's good to kind of inspect where React Native has succeeded and Xamarin may have not succeeded as much. And so one of the things I think React Native does and does pretty well is it provides an additional abstraction on top of the classic native stuff. So whereas Xamarin might have said, hey, this is great. You can create an iOS table view in C# and you can create an Android recycler view in C#. React Native says, oh, well, you have a flat list, which is a singular thing across everybody. Yep. And they really put the effort into making sure that it worked reasonably well on both platforms.
A classically hard problem, but I see what you're saying of there are React Native things that map perhaps to different implementations on the two target platforms, but provide that common interface. So I, as a React Native developer, get to focus on that one interface that I have to work with.
Yeah, and the one concept too, the one concept of a list, instead of worrying about, oh, well, which sections am I using in my UI table view versus, you know, what is my view holder look like on the Android side? So I think...
Is that a thing? A view holder?
It sure is. Holds views. The whole history there.
Well, naming things is, I don't know, I guess it holds views. It does what
it does hold
it's cool.
views.
It's a good name.
So I think that's very interesting. Some of the places where I struggle with React Native is I have no love for JavaScript. If I knew it a lot better, I may have love for JavaScript. though. I don't know that many people that have that much love for JavaScript.
Particularly if you're coming from a place of a bit more certainty in languages mm-hmm. like Kotlin and Swift and Scala, raw JavaScript mm. down to the metal, if you mm. will, is going to be a rough experience. Mm-hmm. The nature of equality and implicit conversions mm-hmm. and things like that, just so many subtle yeah. confusing bugs pop mm-hmm. up. That said, the language has evolved immensely, mm-hmm. and then TypeScript as a layer on mm-hmm. top of that, I think, are really providing a meaningful stepwise change in what it means to yeah. write JavaScript. Yeah. And TypeScript also has gained, even just this year, mm-hmm. it's amazing how much of a stronghold it's taken, as opposed to last year when there were just tons of these different things, and Flow mm-hmm. is a strong contender, mm-hmm. which I think is less and less true over time. But yeah, that said, JavaScript, yeah. it's complicated. It's a complicated language with a complicated mm-hmm. history, and yeah.
Yeah, and I definitely agree. I think TypeScript makes things a lot better. Mm-hmm. So just that kind of struggle interacting with that environment as well. So not just necessarily the language, but kind of the environment that I've found that language brings in. So I've noticed a much bigger flow of being very library happy for React Native apps. So I've noticed there seems to be a path of, I have a complex UI bit, I'm going to search for a library that builds this UI bit, which is very foreign to me from an Android perspective. It's slightly less foreign from an iOS perspective, but I have a very strong sense of, like, I definitely use libraries. I use tons of libraries, of course. I'm not a purist there. But it's a consideration every time. It's like, do we need to bring this in? Like, let's talk about it.
I think that's definitely the JavaScript mm-hmm. community and ecosystem leaking then into the mobile space via mm-hmm. React Native, because a React Hello World app has 1,000 packages yeah, or something like yeah. that. It is amazing yeah. how deep and wide the dependency tree mm-hmm. is for even very straightforward apps. And that then, I think, maps directly into the experience on React Native. So mm. I can see why you would say that.
Yeah, and that kind of filtered over into, I had an experience where for one of those 2 weeks that I was working on a React Native project here at ThoughtBot, I had to upgrade the version or update the version of React Native that we were using, which stopped working with half of the libraries that we were using. And half of that half had pull requests open that would fix against that. And the accepted answers seemed to be target those pull requests mm. instead of the latest released version of that library, which is like a very new concept for me.
Yeah, I mean, that obviously happens. But I don't want to characterize the I don't think you want to characterize the community that way either.
No,
that's
yeah,
not, nobody wants to be doing
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah, of course not. Of course not.
But that it happens. Yeah. And
I don't think that it's a – I'm not trying to say in any way whatsoever that, like, the JavaScript community is, like, those damn kids or anything like that. Definitely not. I think that it's a result of just what the cross-platform tools are trying to do. Mm-hmm. I think that it is hard.
Yes.
And that you're trying to solve problems that have very divergent solutions. So naturally, either you become an expert in all three, which is quite rare, or you reach out for libraries to handle any tidbits that interact with the native side of things.
Right.
You know what yeah. I mean? So I think naturally you will have a lot of libraries, because unless somebody knows about everything all the way down to the metal, then you're kind of forced to.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with the speed with which React Native is changing and just mobile changes in general, I think it's a challenging problem to keep everything up to date.
Yes, incredibly challenging.
Yeah.
I will say the standout for me when looking at React Native is the new accessibility of mobile as a space that I can work in mm-hmm. as a web developer that yeah. I could not, like, I had actively chosen to not dig into Android mm-hmm. and iOS because I felt that that was enough of a departure
yeah.
that I didn't want to make that jump. But I know React. Mm-hmm. I really like React. And mm-hmm. it's not like, oh, it's React, but it's different.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
like, it is not still React,
yeah,
same
it's
sort
the same
of thing.
Yeah.
And so not only the framework, but also then the paradigm around how we build user interfaces in that reactive loop mm-hmm. and set state, and this mm-hmm. is how we manage things. And you and I were playing around on a Friday with an app that uses Apollo and yep. GraphQL and consuming data from a GraphQL endpoint, and it yep. was basically identically the same as to what I would do on mm-hmm. the web.
Mm-hmm.
That was great.
Yeah.
I know how to make these apps.
Yeah.
I can do this, and I can build it for now any of those core platforms.
Mm-hmm.
So that's wonderful in yeah. my mind. But it is interesting because historically, even at ThoughtBot, we technically there are different departments, web mm-hmm. and mobile.
Mm-hmm.
So our developer team is sort of split along that line. And I've never liked that mm-hmm. distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, designer and developer being different in my mind, at least from my experiences, certainly makes sense. I have less capability and less just fundamental skill set in the area of design.
Mm-hmm. What are colors?
Colors and typography and layout and just all of those mm-hmm. aspects are okay. things that are so much more foreign to me.
Yeah.
But mobile, mm-hmm. from a development standpoint, it's just a different type of development. But like, you're still doing programming.
Mm-hmm.
It's both programming.
Yeah.
And design at Thoughtbot is also programming and coding. But the world of mobile seemed both simultaneously accessible and removed.
Yeah.
And so I do like the way that React Native can bridge things. And I think certain applications, we at Thoughtbot have found React Native to be incredibly effective at getting a real product that has a truly native feel, mm-hmm. because it is native in most of the ways.
Sure. Yeah.
It feels native to an end user, and that's what matters. We can build that product that much more quickly.
Yeah.
But I think there are places where it sort of hits a wall.
Yeah.
And so do you have a sense of where that wall is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think whenever you're dealing with stuff that's a little bit closer to the metal, or you really need to squeeze out performance. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for a very animation heavy or with a very custom UI, I would be hesitant to reach for React Native, mm-hmm. especially on the Android side of things. The performance isn't quite there yet. So if you're pushing the limits of the phone's performance, then you're going to want to go with the thing that lets you get closest to those limits.
Mm-hmm.
And React Native has an additional burden. When you're interacting with stuff like the camera and all that sort of jazz, it's a very complicated flow. This is on the Android side of things. On the native layer, and you're going to abstract over a lot of that already when you're going to React Native. So if you were doing something like image processing, like you had a camera and you wanted to do complex filters and stuff mm-hmm. like that, then that's probably not the right.
Don't build Instagram in React Native.
Yeah, yeah. Though they use...
React Native? Wasn't that the like starting point for it?
Yeah. To be clear, though, specific pages within the Instagram app. So,
oh,
like,
that's a good point.
Yeah. Hmm. I think there was kind of a myth going around for a while that Instagram was just written in React Native. And they have written a lot of stuff in Instagram in React Native.
Yep.
But some of the examples I saw were like changing notification preferences,
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. You know, stuff that's kind of a big list with a bunch of clickable cells in it and that sort of stuff. I think that they've expanded a bit past that, but I'm just pumped the brakes on that a little bit.
Honesty and reporting, that's what matters.
Yes, yeah. And then I think it also depends on if you have an existing application. So I know Airbnb tried to incorporate React Native and put in a huge amount of effort
mm-hmm.
into incorporating it, utilizing it, and trying to make it the best it could be. And they, I think, ultimately ran into enough limits. They ended up forking the version of React Native and just had to carry their own version forward. Sounds brutal.
And they have actually moved off it entirely at this point. Or I don't know that they've actually done that, but they've made the decision.
Yeah, so I think it becomes a little bit more challenging, too, when you already have an existing product integrating React Native into mm-hmm. it. It's definitely clearly doable, but I think that's a little tougher. But if you're building your kind of garden variety app, lots of lists backed by a server that serves up a bunch of list items that you're going to save and all that sort of jazz, I think it's a great option.
Mm-hmm. And so many apps, I think, do fall into that
category. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's a super valuable format. That's why so many apps do it.
CRUD rules everything around me.
Yes, it does. So I think that's when you see it really, really, really shine.
Because
it's just so much faster. I would even argue that building a React Native app, even if you're targeting one platform, is often faster than just building for that platform.
I think we have that going on right now with a client app.
I believe. Discord uses React Native to build their iOS app, mm-hmm. and it's a native Android app.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I believe deeply in the dream of React Native. Mm-hmm. Or I guess Tori, who works in our marketing department, I remember one day at lunch, she heard someone talking about a language and she was like, wait, you said a name. Is that different than this? And mm-hmm. talking about a given language. Someone's like, oh, no, it's a different programming language.
Mm-hmm.
And she very emphatically was just like, why do you have so many languages?
That's a great question.
And I'm going to be honest. I kind of agree. And why do we have so many paradigms?
And yeah.
It's because people, I'm pretty sure. I don't think it's a real thing.
Nah.
It's not like we're discovering them. Like we discovered math and there's a bunch of different types of math. It's nothing like that. We made these and we made this mess.
Oh, yeah.
But I believe in the idea of like we're building user interfaces. That, I think, is a constrained enough thing that I would love if there were one language tool chain modality that I could just use. I can build web user interfaces with that. I can build desktop apps with that. I can build mobile apps. And there will be specializations on each of those platforms. But I, as a user interface developer, can do that. Maybe then if you go to the back end and you want to be doing like heavy data pipeline things, maybe that becomes a different at least framework or language or whatever. But so for that reason, I'm long run very much an optimist on React Native. But I'm a little bit cautious in, like, I will tend to lean towards it if we've got a client that seems to fit comfortably into that box. But it's a great idea that maybe isn't fully mature yet, feels true. But I think they're also doing a lot of great work on it, and I see it moving in the right direction. So.
Yeah, definitely.
So we'll have to check back in a year.
Yeah.
Real quick, I do want to touch on the secret fourth option in the mix.
Number four.
Which is Flutter.
Yeah.
Which uses Dart.
Fluttery.
Which is a whole other programming language. It's just another
one out there.
We didn't have enough. What is Flutter?
Yeah, so Flutter is a cross-platform development kit being pushed by Google.
Being pushed by? Or like it?
There is a part of Google that is pushing it. The Flutter team is pushing it.
Well, they are a team within Google, though, right? As opposed to like Kotlin was made by outside, but then.
Yeah,
I just wanted to make sure I was understanding.
Yes. Flutter is made by Googlers.
Okay.
Yeah, so it uses Dart, like you said, which is a language that everyone forgot existed until Flutter started making some
waves. I really
thought
they had stopped doing it.
Yeah, I did too.
And then Flutter came out. I was like, what?
Wow, they're doing it. It's interesting. I have done some Flutter development, and Dart was a similar language where I started using it, and it, you know it. Like, you know it already.
Ooh.
You've never used Dart, I assume. I don't know that.
I have not used Dart.
But you know it.
But I know it.
You know it.
That's good to know.
Yeah. It's very Java-esque with a lot of the goods and the bads that that means. It's not as modern of a language as I would like. You know, you can't do all the stuff that you do in TypeScript or in Swift or Kotlin. But it's also not quite as crufty as Java is. Say it's somewhere in the middle.
Okay. Does it target the JVM at all? I think initially it was meant to compile to JavaScript.
Yeah. And it does still... They'll do that.
I think they still do that. It'd be a weird thing to take away since it was the reason for existing in the beginning. But although I think the intention was for there to be a Dart-specific VM within the browser. So that makes me think then that Dart would not target the JVM at all.
Yeah, I don't believe that it does. And I'm 93% confident that on the Android side of things, it's not touching the Java part.
It's doing a similar bridging to a JavaScript runtime.
No, so actually it's not doing that bridging. And that's kind of part of the like, ooh.
Oh, yeah, a new way to do these sort of things. What's it doing?
So Flutter ships with like a C layer that basically replaces all of the native widgets. So Flutter doesn't use any of the native stuff under the hood. It's not using the table views and the recycler views and the UI views that all mobile developers have come to know and love. It started from scratch.
For those of you in the audience who can't see how high my eyebrows are.
They're so high.
This sounds like a thing that we're not supposed to do.
Yeah, yeah.
But please continue. Yeah, how'd that work out in the end?
Yeah, so that was my initial reaction too, was like, oh, good luck.
But you implemented your own UI library. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, so they've basically treated it like a game engine.
Okay.
So you can think of it as a competitor to, I don't know what game engines exist.
Unity?
Unity, yeah, Unity.
It's only the one now, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
And from my usage of it and what I've seen in the community, it's going quite well. Though when I last left off, it was before Flutter 1.0 had shipped. And my biggest issue with it was it didn't have support for maps yet. So like click around in maps and highlight areas, draggable and all that sort of stuff. And that's not to say that every app needs a map. But if something doesn't provide maps, then it's probably not there yet.
I feel like every app we've done had a map seem to need it, it turns out. It's just such a common interaction point on mobile.
Exactly, yeah.
That it's a weird thing to not have.
Yeah. It also highlighted a specific issue with Flutter's ideology, which is you are not going to remake the map views that Apple and Google provides, and there are some third-party providers, but it's just going to be such a massive undertaking, and you're going to duplicate so much. But they have since solved that issue. You can now use maps in Flutter, and they actually had a really cool example app where you had like a little Android picking up a phone and kind of shaking it, and there was a map within it, and you could – that sort of like smooth interaction with a map is very foreign to me as a native developer. Because they tend to be very special types of views that kind of like break away from all the existing UI logic and is like, actually, we're just going to draw everything in our own weird way.
Kind of pull in some tiles from places.
Exactly.
And,
there's always tiles. So that's kind of the thing with Flutter is that it doesn't need the bridge. It just has that C layer that draws directly to the canvas. And then
the canvas being like a Vue, yeah. a Vue canvas, not in terms yeah. of web technology canvas, not yeah, a yeah, JavaScript
yeah,
canvas.
Yeah, yeah, okay. yeah. I actually don't know the specifics under that hood.
It's drawing pixels it's and drawing then interacting pixels. Touches yes. and interactions yeah. and mapping those. It's yeah. building the entirety of that seems yes. just. Wild. I can't imagine doing that. Mm, yeah. That's so grand of an yeah, aspiration.
Yeah. I mean, the people who could try to do it are Facebook or Google
yep.
or Apple, really.
Yep.
And so the Dart compiles directly down into a layer that can communicate with that C layer. Mm-hmm. So there's no bridge. So that's part of the promise is that Flutter will be faster than React Native.
But there probably is an overhead in terms of each app needs to bundle that runtime.
Yes. Yeah. So size-wise, they're mm-hmm. a fair bit bigger than a native app. I don't know how much bigger they are than a React native app.
Probably that's one bigger. That they're probably comparable, whereas compared to an iOS native or an Android native, yes. you're going to see significantly smaller yes. sizes.
Yeah. I've done some like very minimal speed comparisons, and Flutter has appeared to be a fair bit faster and mm-hmm. less memory intensive.
And you wrote a blog post about that,
I did,
if I remember
yeah.
correctly?
Yeah.
Okay, so we will link to that in the show
yeah,
notes.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, so sync this whole thing up.
Ooh, yeah, yeah. It really comes together end to end.
It's the rug. It brings the room together.
Yes. So it's definitely going to be an interesting thing to watch. It has a similar development paradigm to React. It's clearly heavily, heavily inspired. So you set state and then it rebuilds a widget tree.
Is it a virtual widget tree?
I guess, yes.
Virtual
There's
DOM
no DOM, I think so.
Yeah.
So maybe.
Maybe. I would expect you to be more cautious in your optimism about Dart and Flutter, and you seem to be like, no, it's really cool.
Yeah.
Which sort of caught me off guard when we were first talking about
it. Yeah. Part of the reason for that is because I still view it as in that, ooh, this is a fun technology,
right.
rather than I am not at a point where I would recommend that we build client apps in Flutter. And I think there's a lot of space for optimism and excitement when you're not in production code mode.
Yes.
One of my biggest fears on React Native is that we'll end up with less performant apps. That's been a theme throughout all of my mobile development careers, how to make an app fast, snappy, not be laggy. And React Native, while doing fantastic work in other spots, steps back a little bit from that.
Mm-hmm. And it has to do yeah. more work
yes.
fundamentally.
Yeah, so. Exactly. And they've done amazing stuff to make it as fast as it is. Mm-hmm. Whereas Flutter, I think, has less of a limitation there. Theoretically, it could be faster than the native app, so...
What a dream.
Yeah, what a dream indeed.
Yeah, cautious optimism is where
yes.
we're at, but continue to reevaluate on a monthly
yes.
or something basis.
Exactly, and, yeah.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for joining us and for taking me on a tour of what I would say is probably the entirety of the mobile landscape.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm. If you've enjoyed this episode or any of the others, you can leave us a rating or review on iTunes or share it on Twitter. If you have any feedback for this or any of the other episodes, you can reach us at @_bikeshed, or you can reach me at Chris Toomey on Twitter, or you can email us at hosts@bikeshed.fm. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.
This podcast was brought to you by ThoughtBot. We are experienced designers and developers who turn your idea into the right product. With local studios in Boston, San Francisco, New York, London, Austin, and Raleigh, let's build something great together.